Today, before we get started, I just want to say, Austin, Texas, I see you, and I appreciate your support. Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about, and we're just going to go one by one through some of the articles that I find particularly fascinating. So, without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, say it loud so they can hear you. It feels good to be back. And here we go. We are going to jump right into it. We're not going to waste any time. We are going to get to the first article, which is an article titled, Does Rewording MRI Reports Improve Patient Understanding and Emotional Response to a Clinical Report? Way back earlier this year, I talked about an article in which 50% of the individuals leaving an emergency department with a broken bone didn't know the difference between a broken bone and fracture. 20% of the individuals didn't know or couldn't describe to you non-weight bearing. They didn't really know what that actually meant. And the provider that saw the patient knew that the person had a broken bone, knew that they should tell them non-weight bearing, thought, I'm sure, when the patient was leaving the ER that, oh, the patient has a complete understanding what is going on, but the patient had no idea. And over 50%, a majority, I think it was 60-some percent of these individuals were college educated. It's not like these were the dumbest of the dumb. No, these were relatively smart humans, and they just either were scared or maybe the language is over their head. Whatever it may be, they couldn't figure out that a break and a fracture are the same thing, that a broken bone and a fracture are the same thing, that non-weight-bearing means don't put weight on it. They couldn't figure it out. Well, this study looked at, does rewording the MRI, does it help? What if we put MRI reports in easy-to-understand language? Well, they looked at 100 patients that had MRI of the shoulder, elbow, wrist, and then they reworded the MRI report so it was basically the reading level of an eighth grader. And then they used words such as, instead of tear, they use words like a hole, and they use analogies like a bald spot or a gray hair. Easy things to understand, things that even an eighth grader could understand. And they looked at a whole bunch of outcomes, but the outcome that I really cared about was, does the patient understand the report? Does the patient understand what's going on when they read the report? And they use a 10-point scale, and on this 10-point scale, your baseline understanding before they reworded it was 4 out of 10. 10 being, I completely understand exactly everything that's going on. Your baseline understanding of the reworded report was 8 out of 10. This is huge. This is impressive. This is awesome. I don't know how we can use it in practice. Maybe there's a computer system out there that will take keywords and then just translate in what the radiologist is actually meaning to say. Maybe they'll just translate anytime the patient says a tear or a fracture, they'll just come out and say, this is a broken bone or this. It would take a lot, but if that was possible, how cool would it be to be able to give our patient MRI reports that they could actually understand and that they actually knew what it actually meant? And speaking of things that actually work or maybe actually don't work, but actually are being portrayed as, you'll see what I'm saying. Let's move on to the next title, the next article, if you will, and it is titled Association Between Financial Links in Indoor Tanning Industry and Conclusions of Published Studies on Indoor Tanning, a Systematic Review. In this systematic review, they looked to see if there was a financial link to a paper that was written about indoor tanning. Did that financial link perhaps change what the article was going to say? In all, they looked at over almost 691 articles. That's a ton of articles, letters, empirical articles, systematic reviews, editorials, you name it, they looked at it. And over the whole 700 articles, only 7.2% of the articles had financial links to the indoor tanning industry. 10% of the articles favored indoor tanning, and 4% of the articles were neutral, and then that leaves a total of 85% of all the articles that they looked at were very critical of the indoor tanning. But what happens when you look at the funny money, if you will? Yes, the funding. Among the articles without industry funding, only 4% favored indoor tanning, 3% were neutral, and a whopping 92% were critical of indoor tanning. But if you use the articles that took the money, took the moolah, took the cash, the ones that have financial links to the indoor tanning industry, well then, of those, 98% favored indoor tanning. Remember, if you didn't take the money, 92% were critical. They said this is a no bueno, not good. And if we're all being fair and logical and realistic here, we know that there are harms associated with indoor tanning. And if you're saying otherwise, well, then maybe you've taken the money, the moolah, the cash. Because it looks like when you took the money, the moolah, the cash, you all of a sudden said, oh, look at this. Indoor tanning seems to be really beneficial. The overall takeaway here is that support from the indoor tanning industry was significantly associated with favoring indoor tanning. Risk ratio 14.3. That is a huge risk ratio. In fact, we haven't seen numbers that high on a risk ratio since smoking and lung cancer. And funny enough, when I was listening to an interview with the authors, they basically kind of said that exact statement of, look at how just powerful this is. Look at how the statistical odds are. You are going to say one thing if you're paid, and realistically, the odds are against you if you're not paid for it, or the odds are against the tanning industry if they're not paid for it. The tanning industry, they know it's bad. They know it's harmful. There's no logical individual, either medicine-related or not medicine-related, that says to themselves, and if they're being honest, oh, yes, tanning is so healthy for everyone. No, that doesn't exist. Sure, there are certain medical conditions which may benefit from tanning, but there are certainly harms, and to deny that there are harms or that maybe the harms and benefits aren't pretty close, even in those individuals that need tanning, is just chaotic. And once again, the money rings true. The money rings tried and true throughout the land. And those who say it's not about the money know one thing, and that is it's always about the money. And switching topics, let's talk about giving credit where credit is due, and that is in the FDA. Oh yes, the FDA. I am very critical of the FDA often, but this is one circumstance when I actually give the FDA credit, because ProAir is now generic, and that is because of the FDA. Because under the Generic Drug User Fee Amendments, individual companies can meet with the FDA as part of a pre-abbreviated new drug application program. And they sit down at a table with the FDA and they say, listen, we want to make this drug, XYZ, whatever it may be. In this case, it was ProAir or Albuterol. And they say, we want to make it cheaper. We want to make it generic. How do we do such a thing? Then the FDA tells the company, this is how you should do it. They publish guidance documents describing step by step how they recommend companies complete the application and how they perform or make this generic drug products. And in 2016, the FDA said Albuterol has had enough, and it issued a revised draft product specific guidance for generic Albuterol. 2016, we are now 2020, and we have officially FDA approved generic Albuterol. So cheers to you, FDA. You did a good one on this one, and hopefully I would love to see more generic drugs to come in the future with your assistance. And this next article falls under a title of things that I'm just clearly not smart enough to understand. One of those things that has always made me curious, actually made me inquisitive, made me question, question medicine. And that is a paper titled Oral Anticoagulation for Patients with Atrial Fibrillation on Long-Term Hemodialysis. You see, most of the time, randomized controlled trials of anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation exclude hemodialysis patients. However, in this analysis of observational studies, which included almost 72,000 dialysis patients, they sought to seek the risk and benefits of anticoagulation for those individuals with atrial fibrillation on dialysis. To me, this is a no-brainer. This is sign, seal, and deliver. This is like Jordan in his prime, if you know what I mean. Patients that have atrial fibrillation are more prone to clots. Patients who are on dialysis are more prone to clots. You add 1 + 1, that's got to be 2, and obviously anticoagulation's got to be a good thing, right? Well, not so fast, my friends. You see, of the 16 studies, only apixaban, 5 milligrams, was associated with lower all-cause mortality compared with placebo or no anticoagulation. Warfarin and apixaban were not associated with fewer embolic events. And warfarin was associated with a higher risk for major bleeding than no anticoagulation. This is stunning. We improve all-cause mortality, which is great, but we don't improve it through embolic events. Then how did I expect apixaban to work any other way? I mean, apixaban should be a blood thinner that prevents embolic events, so I don't know how it's improving all-cause mortality if it's not fixing the one thing that I would expect it to actually fix. It stumps me. It mystifies me. It just annoys me, and quite frankly, it makes me question medicine. And speaking of questioning medicine, we're going to talk about one more paper that makes me question what is going on in the world and how you can get a paper published in JAMA Otolaryngology doing it the way that you did it, or doing it the way that these authors did it. And this is going to be the last paper I talk about because I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant. So with that, get ready to sound the horn. Don't let the ship sail out into the ocean without getting on board. Here we go. The last article is titled "Effectiveness of Tonsillectomy versus Watchful Waiting in Young Children with Mild to Moderate Obstructive Sleep Apnea, a Randomized Clinical Trial." Now, before I dig into this study, I will warn you, if you don't like my long rants, if you don't like when I talk about the methodological flaws with a study, then I will promise you, you will hate this next study. It is the last study I'm going to talk about, but it is a study that you should read because next time you read a study, you might also find that this is the problem with medicine, or one of the many problems with medicine and the studies that are put into medicine. So here we go. In this study, they looked to find if adenotonsillectomy or tonsillectomy was more effective than watchful waiting for treating otherwise healthy children between 2 and 4 years of age with mild to moderate obstructive sleep apnea. In total, there were 60 children between ages 2 to 4 years of age with obstructive sleep apnea, and they randomized them to either getting surgery or just watchful waiting. The primary outcome in this study was the difference between the groups in the obstructive apnea hypopnea index score change, meaning the primary outcome was they want to know how many times per night were you having apneic events, how many times a night were you stop breathing, basically, in very eighth grade terms, how many times a night did you have were you stopping breathing. And if you just read the abstract, if you just read the analysis and you're like, oh, well, I guess this must actually work, because in the abstract they say, and I will quote, here we go, both groups had a decrease in mean obstructive apnea hypopnea index score, and the difference in mean obstructive apnea hypopnea index score change between the groups was small in favor of adenotonsillectomy. Now, if you read that, it means both groups did well, but if you had to guess who did more well, who did better, who did less harm, who did more well, that's what we're really looking for. Again, eighth grade terms here, who did more well, just based on that, in favor of adenotonsillectomy. You would say those people that got the tonsillectomy did better. Okay, perfect. I'm going to recommend all my 2 to 4 year olds that have these moderate to severe sleep apnea maybe go get their tonsils taken out. How about it? But that's why you have to read the paper, because when you go read the paper, you will see a difference of 2 in the obstructive apnea hypopnea index score was used as a minimally clinically important difference between the groups with a standard deviation of 2.5. You had to have a change of 2 on the apnea hypopnea index score in order for there to be a clinical difference. Sure, you can have a statistical difference, but if the statistical difference doesn't really matter, then clinically speaking, then why even do the test? It's like the people that say, well, on a 100-point scale, my pain went down from 90 to 87. And they say, well, look at this, clinically significant. We are really improving pain. No, you're probably not. You're probably not at all. Clinically speaking, you're probably not improving anything. Well, they said, here we go. We need a change of 2 on the apnea hypoxia index score. So when you continue to read the study, you will find that the adenotonsillectomy group had a mean obstructive apnea hypoxia index score decrease of 2.9. The watchful waiting group had a mean decrease of 1.9. And the difference between the groups in the mean change was 1. The difference, 2.9 minus 1.9, is 1. And remember, I just told you that they needed at least a 2-point difference. So I read that, and I reread it again, because I said to myself, that can't be right. I just read the abstract, and the abstract just told me, and I'll say it again, both groups had a decrease in the mean obstructive apnea hypoxia index score, and the difference in the mean obstructive apnea hypoxia index score change between the groups was small in favor of adenotonsillectomy. But it wasn't really in favor of adenotonsillectomy. It didn't meet the clinically significant benefit. I mean, sure, it was a benefit. It was a 1-point benefit, but that didn't meet what they already determined needed to be met for clinical significance. And when I saw this, I said to myself, uh-oh, this is a red flag. These authors have something they want to prove, because why in the world would you write your conclusions as being beneficial for adenotonsillectomy when it clearly showed that it actually wasn't? There was no clinical benefit there. There was no clinical difference there. The authors, when you read the paper, go on to say there were large differences between the groups in favor of adenotonsillectomy regarding the obstructive sleep apnea 18 questionnaire. Basically, what they're saying is we have this hard objective outcome that was no difference clinically between whether we did watchful waiting or we took them to surgery, charged them a lot of money, maybe had the kid have to stay home, parent calling from work. There was no difference objectively. However, the individuals that got the invasive procedure, the individuals that got the anesthesia, they had to come in, mom and dad had to take off work, they maybe had to get a little bit of ice cream. The individuals who got that did better in the obstructive sleep apnea questionnaire, a very subjective, are you happier with your sleep apnea score? Those individuals did better. Well, we already know that the individuals will do better when you do an invasive procedure. If you do an injection, that is almost always going to be better than a placebo. If you give a pill and it's given more often, well, then that is almost always going to be better than a pill that is given less often. If you give a pill that costs a lot of money, oh my goodness, you should see how much better that pill works than the cheap secondary generic drugs. Because of course, patients have perceptions of what they think is real, what they think will work. And this just proves that for at least tonsillectomy in those individuals 2 to 4 years old that have mild obstructive sleep apnea, watchful waiting is good enough. Unless, of course, you only care about whether they're happy or not getting the surgery or not getting the surgery. And they are probably happier because this study was not blinded. Oh my goodness, are you kidding me? How do you have a study like this and not blind the patients at least a little bit? Because then when you're going to your follow-up appointments, the patient already knows that they were not blinded to surgery. The physician or the provider also knows you were not blinded to surgery. So every time you're going, are you feeling better? No, I don't think I'm feeling better, even though when you go objectively by the apnea score, you are doing better. You say, I'm not doing better. And then the provider may say something like, oh, well, maybe it's because you didn't get the surgery. I really think we need to get you surgery. You're going to feel so much better. You're going to feel so much happier. And they sell it. They sell it like you wouldn't believe. And it's not their fault. They just truly do believe that it is better, even though we have objective data saying it's not better. This can teach us one of many things. One, we need to blind our studies. Boom. Come on. Number two, don't just read the abstract, because the abstract is whatever the authors think the abstract is, even when it's not what the actual outcome actually is. And number three, the power of persuasion is strong, my friends. We can persuade anyone to do about anything if we just sell it to them hard enough. And life and daily patient encounters are not blinded. We know what we're giving them, and if we sell it to them in just the right way, just likely, it will be beneficial, or at least the patient will be happier in the end. And with that wraps up this episode. So let's end this podcast as we've ended every one before in 30 seconds or less. Let me try to go through what I've talked about so far. Basically, if we can reword MRIs to make it easy for an eighth grader to understand, well, then we would have better understanding of MRIs for all of our patients. I don't know what the patient outcome on this would be, but they would at least be able to understand their diagnosis and maybe better explain it to their physician when they go to follow up care. The association between financial links and indoor tanning, well, surprise, surprise, just follow the money if you ever want to know the truth. And the truth is that tanning is probably bad. Tanning probably has harms. But if you're paid to say that tanning does not have harms, well, then a huge 90-some percent of the time, you say all of a sudden, magically, tanning has no harms and tanning is beneficial. Albuterol is generic thanks to the FDA. Round of applause and kudos to you, my friends. Oral anticoagulation for patients with atrial fibrillation on hemodialysis. I would think this should work. I believe that this should work. I want in my heart for this to work, and unfortunately, it just doesn't really work. I can't quite figure out why oral anticoagulation doesn't work for AFib and hemodialysis patients, but it just doesn't really work. And last but not least, tonsillectomy for young children, 2 to 4 with mild to moderate obstructive sleep apnea. If you're going for the hard objective outcomes, well then hold your breath and watchful waiting is good enough. If you're going for the subjective outcomes that can be easily done with persuasion and convincing that the patient that they didn't get the therapeutic option of surgery that they are entitled to, that would be so much better, well then go with surgery because surgery will make them happier. And with that, I'll end this podcast as I've ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.